Welcome to Money and Racism, the podcast that delves deep into the intersection of finance and racial disparities. I'm your host and money EQ specialist, Dr. Joe Burns. I'm here to guide you through a series of thought-provoking conversations with people of color that aim to uncover the intricate relationships between money and systemic racism. Whether you're curious about the subject, seeking insights, or ready to join the fight against systemic injustices, money and racism is your space to learn, discuss, and take action. So, join us every week as we engage in free-flowing conversations that challenge the status quo and encourage critical thinking. Together, we'll work towards a more equitable and just financial world. On today's episode, we have Dr. Lynn Marine Hurdle. She is a communication expert and conflict resolution strategist, diversity, equity, and inclusion facilitator, speaker, and leadership coach with over 40 years of experience in blending the connection between communication, conflict, and culture into her unique style of engagement for leaders. She is the author of the bestseller, Closing Conflict for Leaders. Prevention, intervention, and transformational conflict resolution are all at the heart of her work. Her expertise is in engaging clients with creative processes designed to create dialogue and teach skills that can be used in the everyday and the most difficult conversations and leadership situations. The belief that helping people transform their lives begins with transforming your own led to her well-received TEDx Women Talk entitled The Weight of Hate. Dr. Lynn created the Soul of Conflict Summit, a groundbreaking online forum designed to create deep dialogue around conflict, old wounds, and healing, because she knows that leaders who willingly and skillfully engage in conflict will be our most successful leaders. Dr. Lynn survived a life-threatening racial incident at 17 years old. She remembers escaping and walking home from the incident thinking of only one thing. I don't know how, but I have to do something with my life that brings people together around these issues. She had no idea where this save the world and help people deal with conflict idea came from, because she had just enrolled at Syracuse University as a theater major. However, Dr. Lynn believed that somebody knew something about her future regardless of whether or not that something was part of her plans. In her junior year, switched to the Maxwell School of Citizenship's new Nonviolent Conflict and Change major. It is with this intention of bringing people together around issues of race that for over 3 years, she has led the sold-out group On the Matter of Race, a six-month journey for white people who want to learn about racism and take action. Dr. Lynn has grown OTMR from one group to seven, including a C-suite group in a major corporation, and now co-facilitates six of the groups with her youngest son. Dr. Lynn has taught as an adjunct professor and visiting professor at NYU, John Jay College, and Syracuse University. She is an educational consultant with two online courses in conflict resolution for YouThrive Educational Services. She also has three online courses in conflict resolution and communication through Madecraft, which caters to the business world. She writes a weekly blog on all things conflict entitled From Where I Sit. For 2 years, she regularly contributed articles about breaking culture, conflict, and cultural breakthroughs for Psychology Today. She has been featured in Forbes, Redbook, Thrive Global, local television, and numerous podcasts. She is straightforward and uses an engaging approach in her interactive workshops, keynotes, and coaching programs. Dr. Lynn has had the privilege to deliver her unique trainings, workshops, and deep coaching to leaders from Harlem to Hong Kong and from South Bronx to South Africa. She brings a wealth of knowledge, experience, and her special energy to every client. So please help me welcome Dr. Lynn Marine Hurdle. Welcome, Dr. Lynn. Thank you so much for being here. I'm super excited to have this conversation that we're going to have today about money and racism. That's a really broad subject. And I think for this conversation, like, I know there's a lot of stuff you want to talk about, but I want to kind of talk about, because this is a special session for me, I think, because it's only because of you that this is happening.
Thank you.
You've been on me for, we're going to say, years now to get this done. And it's went like lots of different areas, and it could have been lots of different things, but I'm pretty happy with, I think, what it's going to turn into be and all that. So I think just a big shout out to you, and thank you so much for your continued support in making this whole project happen and holding my feet to the fire to make sure I get it done. And then I have these conversations. As we know, these conversations are super important to have and much needed. Yeah. So again, just thank you so much as we start this out for making this happen, and you'll be forever in my heart and something very special in this whole conversation.
Oh, thank you.
You've taught me so much, and I'm much different than I was very, you know, years ago when we started down this journey.
That's correct. First of all, thank you for having me, and thank you to anybody tuning in, everybody tuning in. I hope you're tuning in from all kinds of places. near and far. Number one, you're the person to have the conversation. I mean, you know, transparency, you're my money coach. And what I love about this particular broadcast that we're doing is, as you said, it's a broad subject, and some people can bring it into one place specifically. Money, the bills you have in your pocket, in your wallet, and in your bank account, but it is so much wider, particularly when we're talking about racism and money. So for me to be able to have the conversation with you, having been and continue to be in on the matter of race, and then for you to be in relationship with me around money, it's the perfect combination. I'm thrilled to be here.
I love it. And for those listeners who might not know or whatever, just to make sure we all are on the same page, Dr. Limerine Hurdle, she does run a group called On the Matter of Race that specifically teaches white people about racism in America and helps them deconstruct it. And we have lots of very deep, interesting conversations. So just as a side note, that's what she meant when she said that, because, you know, out of full disclosure, I've been going through that for, it's been like 4 years now, right? At the time of this recording, it's been a while that we've been running through talking about and having these conversations. And I'm a whole different person because of it. So
awesome. Yeah.
Lynn, talk to us. When you think about like money and racism, from all the experience you have, right, and everything you've been through in life, what comes up for you? Like, what is the first kind of that thing that comes up? And you're like, oh, this is what I got to talk about when I hear these two things together, because they are very broad subjects. They're very polarizing subjects in and of themselves, right? And now we're taking both and we're kind of mashing them together. I'm trying to have one conversation about it. There's a lot to talk about.
Absolutely. And I was thinking about it. I've been thinking about it for a while. Like, where do I want to go with this? Because there is a lot to talk about. And I don't want to do the numbers, the statistics. I know some folks like that. I will talk about the subjects where you can do the research on the numbers. I'll tell you approximately. But basically, I'm much more about stories and impact of racism on money. So the first thing I really wanted to talk about is mindset. Because for me, that was huge. And for so many people of color, I know, not just the fact that I've come from a big family, that we have conversations and a lot of my friends are of very different backgrounds, not just that, but the fact that I know the impact that it had on me also had the same impact on others. And so I'll start with, I started out very early. Mindset was, you know, you got to get a job. You got to have your own money. And I was never asked to contribute to the household. I had both my parents in the household. My dad really like worked himself to death almost. He had three jobs my entire life and was an amazing dad. One of his jobs, he worked for the Department of Education. And so summers he had off and he would take us everywhere, to the beach, wherever, during the day. And then he had to show up for a 4 to midnight shift at the post office 5 nights a week. And then he had an additional job as well. So I got the work ethic, right? I got very clearly, you got to work, have your own money, bring your home. And it really kind of hustle mentality too, because he could have just worked one job, right? But he really went out and did what he had to do in order to make sure that the money was coming into the household. But one of the biggest things around combining that mindset with racism and money is this mindset around, we have to make sure that our people are okay. Nothing wrong with making sure that our people are okay, but what that equated to was, since many of us, unfortunately, the majority of us were doing poorly or not doing as well as we would have wanted to be doing, that meant that helping out your community meant when you decide what career you're going into, a lot of us went into the service jobs. They ain't gonna get you rich, I'm gonna tell you. Right?
A lot of service jobs don't pay very well, right? Or like government, social work, stuff like that. Like,
and yes, you have the saving mentality or whatever, but what are you saving for? So I did that. I went straight into nonprofits. Pretty much everybody in my family was in education. Some were teachers, but some didn't have the education to be teachers. So they were paraprofessionals. My dad ran a lot of parent programs. So I went into nonprofits. I worked for my people, and it was great until it wasn't. And that wasn't was when I was like, surely I can do more than this. Surely I can, you know, watching all these people have wealth, right? And I'm, surely I can be among them. And so I said to my dad one day, you know what? I think I'm going to take my talents to the corporate world. And he looked at me and he said, oh, so you're going from the needy to the greedy, huh? And I can't even tell you, because my dad and I were very close and I just adored him and respected him. And I can't tell you what that did to me. I was crushed that I was in some way letting my community down and moving away to really the white community, because corporate is still very predominantly white, right? Especially in power position. So it took me 3 years to finally say enough after he had said that, because I really felt the feelings around that is the loyalty that you have. That's the commitment that you have, because essentially the message is we're not going to be the group that has the predominant wealth in this country. So you can't move away from us. If you really want to be loyal to and help your community, then you stay in your community and you stay in jobs that are giving service predominantly to your community. And that is a very troubling mindset to me. Not the community and the loyalty, but the fact that you have to think smaller than you are financially, right? And that you envision your people never getting out of it in large numbers. And so everybody's got to make this commitment to making less money than they really can, because we got to go into these kinds of jobs.
Yeah. Just thinking about that, because you look at the trauma being handed down through generations, right? And that's the culmination of what you just described. It makes me think of Tulsa, right? That as the Black community starts to thrive, then you've been taught that bad things will happen.
Right.
There was another one, and I don't want to get this wrong, but I think it was Durham, where there was another large Black community that was thriving. And they got smart. This was after Tulsa, but they're like, we're going to stay just under the radar of the white community so we don't get taken out, right?
Right.
It's frustrating to me, and it's saddening to me that that has to be the mindset. Like, you know, going back to mindset, like you said, that has to be the mindset of the community you grow up in, because if you want to be safe, right?
Yeah.
You can't rock the boat.
Right.
Back to what you're saying too, right? If you can't break out and go to corporate, or you have to stay within the community, then you just keep using the same dollars that are already available to the community, which are not a lot.
Right.
There's no new wealth that joins that can help elevate the community. And it just continues to be fighting for whatever you can get, which is also another problem piece, right? When you look at how you can survive and how you can grow that wealth, because there's no new influx of cash, then it's just whatever the community can do. And that's not always necessarily a good thing.
No, it's not. And then at the same time, it's, you know, like there's so much there, because I can remember, you know, church is big in the African American community. And before I say that, I want to say also that I've always had friends of all different races and ethnicities. And one of my closest friends is Puerto Rican. And we would have conversations about this cultural idea or cultural norm that you don't make yourself bigger than the culture. You don't make yourself bigger than the community. So you rise, you know, show us to be smart and strong and educated, but don't go too far, because then you're too big for us. Then you're saying you're better than the community, right? And so again, so if you really pursue, and it, you know, in these days, it doesn't have to just be corporate. It can be entrepreneurship. But if you pursue it to the heights of wealth, right? Of real wealth, financial wealth. What are you saying to your community if the rest of us can't go with you or aren't doing that with you? But at the same time, and it's like a joke sometimes in our community, I grew up with the church having the building fund where they'd have this like a thermometer, and it would show in red the thermometer amount rising, like the temperature as to how much money had been contributed to the building fund. And after a while, it was just stopped at not even halfway. And every single church that had a building, but people, you can't get from people who don't have. And that's was right in the community. We'd have a bake sale for everything. And God knows I love me some baked goods and baked sales. But what is that funding, right? Truly funding the community, giving away, helping each other, giving away food, feeding each other. All of this is great stuff, except who's moving up in the community to the point where there is enough numbers where we really are lifting ourselves and each other out of poverty, where we're really moving into a wealthy place. Or the few that made it out for all kinds of reasons, many didn't turn back around to help anybody else, right? Many said, I got mine, you get yours, that kind of mentality. And so for me, when I made that decision and said, you know, Dad, I got to do this, part of it came from, well, can I help better if I'm doing better financially? Like, isn't that also a way to help? Because I'm never going to forget who I am. I'm never going to forget my community. Hey, I grew up, my parents moved into an all-white community and busted their butts to stay there, really. I mean, that's one of the reasons my dad had three jobs and my mom also worked. They really wanted to do that, not because it was all white, but because white schools were the better schools. We weren't getting the same education. But I was still going back to my grandparents, my aunts, my cousins, like where they lived, and where they lived were in communities that were not doing well financially. So I still was loyal to and committed to and in love with my people and my community, but I couldn't see that the only way to really help and serve was to just work in fields where I barely paying my own bills, and now I'm trying to help you with yours. So once I made the commitment that I wanted to move up and do better financially, I was able to give in numbers that I couldn't even fathom giving in when I wasn't working to do well financially, when I wasn't just working in a job that said, hey, I'm serving my people and I feel really good about that. So I think that that's the other piece, too, is that it limits your imagination, your creativity in terms of ways in which you can bring in money. And we are creative people, trust and believe. I mean, we are creative people. I love going into my community and getting whatever, whoever's selling right stuff or whatever. And whatever you think about that, you think about that. But I know that that's how people survive.
Yeah,
and what they have access to. So I love that. But I really feel like if you're not looking for how you can succeed even better financially and working towards that, then you are not using all of your creative genius.
I would agree, because there are so many creative, like everybody's creative, right? And again, back to what I said earlier, right? When you keep that all in one area and you don't branch out, it's really hard to inject new resources into what's going to help the community rise as a whole, right? And, you know, just like back to the story where your dad says, oh, you're going from the needy to the greedy. I understand the perception, right? Because even today, you look at corporate and it's like, they're making a lot of money and not much is trickling down, right? Failed politics and failed policies.
Right.
But the crazy part that's always interesting to me is how that gets so ingrained in our mindset and how we think, and then how we start to respond to that.
That's correct.
In a way to be like, oh, I can't be that over there, so I'm just going to stay over here. And like you're saying, like when you decided, hey, enough is enough and I'm out of here, then life got better, right? And you could see, hey, this is how I can help support my community still while still living a better life for myself, where you don't have to work three jobs like your dad worked.
Right.
Right. That's insane. I guess we probably had that conversation before I did, but I didn't realize that.
Absolutely. Until he retired, that was exactly what he did, running himself down and volunteering. Like I said, we were in the church, all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And hear me good, people. I'm not putting down any of that in terms of the ideas behind it. But what I am saying is that mindset does limit you. It does keep you in fear as well. There's this peace that I know a lot of white people don't know about. And that is when you do things like go into corporate, or even when we moved into a white neighborhood, then you're accused of acting white, right? Of wanting to be white. And that is a huge thing that we deal with, because there's a lot of pride in being African American, being Black, right? There's a lot of pride in that. And white, it's not an insult. It's just that it's saying that you would rather be these folks than us, because all that we see in these spaces are white people. When you think about wealth, yeah, somebody's probably sitting there saying, oh, but what about this one? What about Oprah? What about the athletes? Yeah, you can point out, but that's not the majority. When you look at corporate, the majorities in corporate are still white people, in particular white men, right? So when you can look at corporate and say that, yes, people of color are the majority, then we can have a different conversation. But that's what Black people thought in terms of you trying to do better than what you had been doing and wanting to have the kind of wealth, wanting to live in the communities where there are big homes and, you know, the things that people want, genuinely want for themselves, all of those things. So that was the accusation, particularly when I was growing up. And it stayed that way for a long time, because I know just talking to younger people as they were coming up too, they all got accused of the same thing. And the other thing is too, right, you're talking about racism and money, that the kinds of things that you have to do then to make yourself acceptable in those environments also got you accused of acting white or wanting to be white, meaning straightening your hair. I think all Black people have been through that. Our hair is not acceptable. You don't know about the Crown Act that was just passed a year ago.
The fact we have to pass a law so that it's acceptable is just, it floors me.
That's right. Right? So think about that. That's racism and money. You are affecting the places that I can work, and particularly places where I could make really good money, by saying that my hair is not professional. And hair is so personal. I saw a video today of a young Indian American woman who was talked about how our hair is so important to us. It is such a big part of who we are. And I resonated with that, because I feel the same thing around Black hair, that it's very important to us. And yet that's something so many of us have had to change, either wear wigs or straighten it or not work in corporate. Right. So racism and money in action right there. And that's just one of the things. You have to make sure you speak a certain way. My mom went through great lengths to make sure that we were not discernible as Black folk over the telephone. Because I grew up in a time when you would call about a job and wanting to get an interview, you'd have to call on the telephone. And it was good and it was bad, because if you did get an interview, once you showed up, they were shocked that you were Black, because you didn't sound like that over the phone. So, yay, Mom, mission accomplished, but now what?
Yeah, you have the next barrier to entry right when they actually see you, which is another just like...
That's right.
So fascinating. And just like, you know, simple things like the hair. And I know I read something not long ago, there was because schools policies are still trying to push that, right?
Oh my God. Yes.
There was a young Black boy who, and they showed pictures, and it was nicely kept. It was long, but he kept it up, right? It was not against the rules if you were to read it, right? Because it says it has to be above whatever, the collar, all that stuff. Yeah. But because when it was down, it was longer, then he got put in suspension and like got kicked out of the school and all these crazies. And it's like...
For nothing.
It is. Your hair now depicts on how much money you can make, which is just, again, the opportunities and things like that, right? Which all equate to money. And it is just baffling to me that we care so much that those people, I guess, who work for us in corporate are so cookie cutter, that they look like us, they act like us, that we can't have diversity. And then we wonder why there are issues with innovation and ideas and stuff like that. It's because we all look and act the same.
Yeah. And you wonder why people are angry, quite frankly. Because they know that for Black people, we know that there have been certain things we've been told. Get a good education is one of them. You try to do that, or you go and you do that, and then there's another stopping block. Or as you said, this young man is just trying to get his education.
Yeah.
And we're not even talking about college, and you're already stopping him. or trying your hardest to stop him or control him, make him look the way you want him to look because you're uncomfortable with it, because this has nothing to do with whether or not this young man can do well in school or not. We do all these things, and then there's always something else that's put in place that is meant to serve us. That's right.
Always moving the goalposts, right? It's like, oh, you have to do this. And then the community responds, right. And it's like, oh, no, that's not good enough. Now we got to do something else.
That's right. Absolutely. And it is everything from the fact that we weren't able to vote for so long, or let's go back even before then, the fact that we were not able to be taught how to read. That was a law, right? That we could not be taught how to read. So we could not read. We could not learn to read. We could not learn to write. So many of us grew up with grandparents who absolutely didn't have a past third grade education or couldn't read or couldn't write. And so what do they then get to pass on? Because one of the things that helps to create wealth is generational wealth. Things that you get to pass down to pass on. Yeah. Things like homes and things like money or even jewelry, things that are of value that you can pass on. But you have folks that weren't even allowed to have access to anything that could create that. I never received a gift from my grandmothers ever in my entire life, except the gift of their love and presence, which was wonderful. I loved them, but they wanted to have something to give and they just didn't. They couldn't. They were barely able to hang on themselves. And so what does that do when then the next generation has that mindset that we got to help out the community, we got to stay here, we can only make so much, or we are going to be accused of not being of the community? And then you're passing that on to my generation. And if I'm not really paying attention and intentional, I'm passing that on to my kids.
Yeah, because it's familiar, right? It's like, this is what we've been taught. This is what we can do. So it's like, we're just going to keep handing it down until someone like you comes along and says, nope, I'm not going to do it that way. I'm going to do something different because I know and I can see the life can be different.
That's right. And still be loyal. There's so much in terms of racism and money and mindset, even things like depression, right? To feel like if my grandparents, all they really had was hope, they couldn't see that things were going to be better for us.
Yeah.
They would say you could be anything you want to be, but they didn't really believe that by sight. They were holding on to faith, but they didn't believe that by sight. Because there was no indication that racism was ever going to let go of the hold that it has on this country and allow us to actually have the kind of opportunities that weren't and still aren't in many cases afforded to us.
Yeah. And that's hard, right? When there's just hope for a better day, but there's no actual data, right? And you talked about data in the beginning, and we're not going to share data. Like, the story's much better. But there was no data, right? Even in the stories that said, hey, life is going to be better. If I can just hold out, or if I can do this one thing, then, you know, my kids, my grandkids will have a better life. It was never like that, right? Like, it's maybe they, and that hope and that strong will to be like, something's got to change eventually.
Yeah.
But is it hard to instill principles on things you're not quite sure of onto your posterity if you're like, well, there's a bit of doubt there. There's a lot of doubt there because in my lifetime, nothing's changed. So,
and can't give you a blueprint for how to change it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing. We talk about money and racism. Who and what do you have access to? We're talking about someone that we both know, Dr. Lauren. He had a guest on his show. And she went from being in the gangs and going to prison to really changing her life to the place where not only is she doing very well financially, but she's being mentored by a couple of billionaires. So think about the access, right? You might want to get that access in the community. And again, nothing wrong with the community, great folks in the community, but what do they have access to? Who do they have access to in terms of being mentored into spaces where you can move up and do better? The mentorship is unfortunately often in whatever they have access to. Sometimes it's illegal things that they have access to that bring great money. Now, temporary, dangerous, doesn't lead to long life in most cases, but that's what you have access to. You need to pay bills. You have dreams of doing better financially. Then many people are going to take that route. And even people who didn't take that route, who took the route of education, who then came back to the community to give, as much as that's not something that they would want to do, to engage in anything illegal, they often wonder, you know, like, what am I doing? Right. They're making all that money. Right. No, seriously, they're making all that money. Yeah, again, they're not going to do it. But to have to wonder that also is troubling, because why shouldn't you have access to people in places where you can be mentored into a better life financially?
Yeah, I agree 100%. Because I'm not saying that people wouldn't get there without a mentor, but I know through my own coaching mentors, and you know this, if we have a mentor, someone who's already been through something, they know how to help you get there faster, right? And they have the connections and the people and the resources to be able to help you get there. So not saying that, you know, people can't, right? Because I know everybody always comes back and says, but, you know, and says, it's possible. Yeah, it's possible. But what's probable? What's the probability of things happening? And it really isn't. Like, without access to different thoughts and different patterns of thoughts and different ideas, it's going to be a lot harder to get there, you know, versus having the access.
Access to where business takes place, right? For the longest time, golf course, who's got access to that if you are not in those spaces, right?
Yeah.
And if you decide that that's a white thing or whatever, right? Because that's the mentality that's being passed on to you. I do want to share a story too about passing things on. So I just want folks to think about this. So if you kept hearing stories, everybody in your family telling tales about your great, great grandparents who actually had all this money, and they had a great big house, they doing really well, living life well, and then another family stole everything, took everything that they had. So there's nothing to pass down to your grandparents. And as a result, there was nothing to pass down to your parents. And they really didn't have much to pass down to you, right? We're talking about financial wealth, right? And even real estate, which is can equate to money, right? Absolutely.
Yep.
But you did some digging and you found out who this family is. And not only did you find out who the family is, but you see them from time to time. You've heard them talk about how they worked so hard for this money, right? Because they have great jobs that do bring in money, but you know that they're sitting on money and they were able to build their wealth on money that was taken from your great, great grandparents. You know where they live. You know what they're worth. You just gonna let them have that? You're not even gonna try to track it back and say, you know, you owe us because you stole that from our family. And that means you have made sure that we did not have wealth to pass down. And now we're coming for you. I think that can resonate with a lot of people.
I think so. But if that was my family, I'd be all about like, let's right this wrong.
Me too.
Right.
Okay. So let's go back to the African slave trade in the United States of America, where that provided the financial wealth of billions, over $4 billion. We know that that's true. Now, some of you listening may not, but you can look it up.
Yeah, that's a real number. And that's a lot of money, especially considering the time.
It's a lot of money that never, ever, 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 ever got paid to the descendants. So here we go. The minute we talk about reparations, people don't want to hear it.
Yeah, because they're like, oh, well, that wasn't me. And I have to be honest, like, to completely transparent, because this is what this whole conversation is about. That was before I really started diving into my own thoughts and my beliefs around racism. that was one of mine too. I'm like, I always warred with that, but this is not me. Like, I didn't cause this. And that's true, right? I didn't cause that, but I know there's a problem. And so I'm here and I'm aware enough of it that I can help fix it now. Right. And I think that's a big shift for myself. Like, I can't go back and like tell my ancestors to not be stupid, but what I can do is I can do something now about it. So just, you know, kind of my whole thoughts around this as well. It's like,
because you can acknowledge that.
Yeah, there's a lot that needs to be done.
You can acknowledge that it happened. You can acknowledge that this country got very wealthy off of Black lives, right? Sweat, pain, murder, all those things. Babies, everything, right?
Yeah.
Sold off. You can acknowledge that. So if you can acknowledge that, then you can understand why, with the condition of the African-American community, except for the exceptions that, of course, folks are going to point out, right? But you can understand why when we hear people say, well, I got this on my own, or our family doesn't owe anything because we didn't own slaves. But in the meantime, you've had all of this, even real estate to pass on. No, no. Those of us who understand what that meant in terms of financially building this country and building the country off the labor too, but just exactly what it brought in terms of financial wealth, we understand that there is a debt that's owed. We do understand that because, as I said, if it were you and you knew exactly where they lived, and we know where this country is, we understand, right? We know where the country is. If it were you, and you saw them and they're also talking about how they did it on their own, but you knew better. Can't tell me you wouldn't want to go after that and say that, yeah, well, that's really owed, right? It's the same thing whether you had slaves or not. And a lot of people who say that have never even traced it. They don't even know. They just say that, right? My family does. You don't even know.
They're just like, no, my family would never do that, right?
Right. You don't even know.
Yeah.
And then you don't have to be a direct descendant to look at how the country has accumulated wealth, and in particular, that the success of many white people today sits on the strength of and the back of that wealth.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can believe me or not, but it really doesn't take a lot to investigate that. And at least, whether you feel like you should be paying or not, at least you can understand, yeah, I get why they say they're owed the money. Because on top of that, to validate that we are owed, many of you may not know that the slave owners were paid reparations, because once slavery was ended, in quotes, it was decided that they needed to be compensated for losing property, not their homes, people, Black people.
Yeah.
They had to be compensated for losing property, but there was no compensation for those who were seen as, sold as, used as, murdered as, abused as, burned as, hung as property. Come on now. Come on now. You cannot sit with that and tell us that we are wrong to say that we are owed.
Yeah.
No matter if you can come up with how it could be paid, that's not what I'm saying. I need you to just come to the understanding that, yes.
I think that's the biggest problem right now, because everybody wants to go to, oh, it's going to cost so much money, blah, blah, blah. They want to figure a cost. And it's like, we're not even to that conversation yet, right?
Right.
If we can just get the collective to say, yes, this is needed, we can come to a solution much faster. But because there's so many that deny it.
That's right.
It's just a fight in the conversation to even get to what can we do to resolve it. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate, you know, because again, like you're saying, tons of opportunity. And for all everybody listening, like for the white people out there, I get that. I can say it for myself. Like, I was one of those guys who thought, well, I didn't cause it, all this stuff. Everybody has the same opportunity as me. And I was horribly wrong. Mm-hmm. Everybody doesn't have the same opportunity as me because I'm a white man in America. And even if I feel like my life's been hard, it hasn't been hard because of the way I look. Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest problem. Mm-hmm. The systems are set up to support the way I look.
Yeah.
And to not support everybody who doesn't look like me.
That's correct.
And that's the problem.
That's right.
You know?
And it develops this mindset that I earned this all on my own. Nobody's saying things to earn this. You went and you worked hard, you got an education, you moved on up. But having the right skin color also being a man.
Yeah.
That played a huge part as well. Just like somebody who looks like me did all the same things you did, but my skin color worked against me because they did not want me there simply because of it, right? And then being a woman as well. It really is about trying to get people to see that, right? So when you see all of these folks in whatever your industry is and they look like you, if you're white, you are convinced that it's because they all earned that opportunity. I'm going to tell you that most likely not everybody did, but let's say they all did. But that's because that's the favored opportunity, right? It's not because people who look like me aren't capable. We just weren't welcome.
Yeah. There's a huge difference there.
Yeah.
My corporate career before I left was in IT, right? And I was just a bunch of white dudes and occasionally some women. And then as outsourcing started happening, it was a bunch of white dudes and people from India and a few women and a few people of color from outside, right? That's for the whole time. And I was in the corporate space for like 25 years. Mm-hmm. And that's all I ever saw.
Yeah.
And then people say, well, everybody has the same opportunity. So many times then I heard, oh, well, they're just not interested in this field. I'm like, they're not interested here because they can't get hired. That's why they're not interested. That's why they're not showing up. That's why they're not here, because we're not hiring them. Yeah,
that's right. Because y'all don't know us.
Yeah.
If you don't know, because again, so much of hiring also comes from who you know.
Yep.
And if you all don't know us, you're not in friendships with us, you don't work with us because you don't, not hiring us, certainly in any kind of numbers, right? Then we're not there for the opportunities that you would afford to someone else who looks like you, because not only do they look like you, but they're also in some relationship with you, whether it's someone you work with or someone you have socialized with or someone you're related to or someone who's your best friend's best friend. I mean, all of that stuff
yep.
happens. And if you can listen to what I'm saying without judging it, but simply processing it for understanding, you would understand all of these things do add up. They're not excuses. They're not complaints. I'm just putting it out there when we talk about racism and money and the relationship between so many things that happen in this country and even in the world, but I'll stick to the United States, then you can at least start to understand. I'm not asking you to solve it. I'm just asking you to listen for understanding, because it is not talk that is just made up. It is reality.
Yeah.
And it isn't that we aren't great scientists. We aren't great tech people. We aren't great entrepreneurs. It isn't that. It's that the opportunities are not the same, whether you believe that they are or not, right? They're just not.
I agree, right? And for those listening, it's not calling out one person, because a lot of people can be like, but I'm not that way. Well, probably not, but the system is. And I think, like you were saying right there, to recap a little bit, like if we could just get more people to acknowledge there's a problem, then we can start to see some type of change. Mm-hmm. But if we can't even acknowledge a problem, then change is so far down the road that it's not even in the plans, because we can't get enough people on board to be like, oh yeah, there's a problem and we need to do something about it. Because mm-hmm. that's really what it is.
Yeah.
We need an awakening amongst the white people.
Yeah.
In a way that says, hey, yeah, there's some really stupid stuff we've done in the past. And again, not particularly my problem, but I've been supporting those systems. So what can I do to help not support them anymore? Mm-hmm. What can I do to talk against them, to start shifting my mindset and my perception, so that when I see something, I can say something and say, hey, that's not right. Or I can start making different decisions in my hiring process. Mm-hmm. Right. I can start really looking and saying, how can I provide opportunities to everyone, and particularly people of color, so that now we can start elevating the voices who have great ideas. They've just never been given that opportunity to express those ideas, or been turned down so many times that they're just like tired of it. Like we're talking at the very beginning of the call, they just go back to their communities and be like, well, this is where I belong. And so I'm going to help elevate this community. Mm-hmm. And then we lose out on so much.
Yeah. And even like I said, so I know the reparations discussion is not popular, but I'm just asking you to look at it from a very different way. I'm not asking you to solve it. I'm not asking you to say, well, yeah, I know how we can pay it, or I don't know how we can pay it. I'm asking you to actually understand it to the place where you can say, Yeah, we owe it. I don't know. Don't ask me how we gonna do it. Like, yeah,
and I agree. I'm huge on this conversation. We've had this conversation before, you know, in other conversations, but I'm huge about it. Even thinking from like going into my work of the EQ side of money and how we feel about money and, you know, all that kind of mindset and emotional stuff, there would be a huge healing if we were to start having that conversation, right? That has to be part of the healing process. And the longer we push it away, the just the more festered it's going to get. It's never going to resolve itself on its own. We have to do something about it. And we need more people talking about it. But again, we're talking about money and people freak out when they talk about money anyways. So they continue to avoid that conversation. Right. Both these conversations they avoid because they're like, oh, you know, the good people like, oh, I'm not racist. And I don't have problems with money. I have enough. But really, we do. And if we could acknowledge that, then we can start making some changes and we can start helping all the communities out. Yeah. Right. But mostly with ourselves and becoming better people and have a better society.
Yeah.
Because it sucks continuing to have these conversations. I'm so glad that you have these conversations with white people.
I am too.
Because it's totally changed my mind and my life.
I want to say one other thing to my people of color who are out there, not just my community, all folks who are like, well, why are you asking for a handout? We don't need a handout. I'm not asking for a handout. Go back to my story. The way I said, if you knew that your family was robbed of what should have been passed down to your family that could have provided a better way of life for your family and you knew where them people lived. And all they're talking about is how they made it on their own. And you know the foundation of them making it on their own was really your money. Go to your family. Don't tell me you wouldn't go for it. Don't tell me you wouldn't say to yourself, well, I don't want a handout. No.
Especially with reparations, that's one big part of this conversation. This is not another social program of handouts and like, like you're saying, paying back what's owed. And that's a whole different conversation.
Yep. It sure is.
So many people have a hard time grasping that concept.
Yes. Well, today we're going to learn.
That's right. We're going to start changing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Dr. Lynn, this has been an amazing conversation. I mean, as long as I've known you, like I've even learned some new stuff.
Yeah.
I love having conversations with you, especially about these two subjects. I've done a lot of growing and I have a lot of growth still to do on the racism side, but I love having the conversations because it challenges my beliefs. You know, one thing I think that was an aha for me, right? We had a meeting the other day, you and I, with a group of other people from a conference we went to. And as I was speaking, right, and this has really hit me in the last couple of days, and I think it's appropriate for today's conversation because as people go through and eventually we'll maybe talk about it in another conversation, but the whole concept of white fragility, and there's been books written on it and stuff like that. But I had an aha in my own mind, right? That I, as a human being, am not fragile, but my beliefs are.
Yeah.
Right. And so if I can attack these beliefs, if I can think a different way, if I can let go of the fragile ones, the ones that don't benefit me or other people, then I can be a stronger person and I can help lift all this. You know, I think of like, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats, right? If we can be that and have these conversations and willing to have the hard conversations and not think about like, oh, am I going to get hurt in this? Well, I hope not. Am I going to be challenged in this? I hope so. And that's how I like to approach these conversations because I don't know everything. At probably one point in my life, I probably thought I knew everything, you know, and like they always say with age comes wisdom and you figure out how much you don't know.
Yeah.
But willing to have these conversations and willing to go here. You know, again, like we talked about at the very beginning, this is one reason why I wanted to create this show, right? Was to have amazing guests on here like you, but also help people start to challenge their own thoughts and beliefs on what they really believe in and think about like these two topics as we're kind of mashing them together and just see what comes up. And hopefully what I want to do is promote conversation right around some really tough subjects and some really what could be polarizing conversations, but hopefully some people can let those fragile beliefs kind of fall to the side and really say, okay, what am I not seeing here? Because if there's anything in my whole time with you, it's again, not is this racist, but how is this racist, right? And it changes a lot of the conversation now in looking and saying, okay, what am I not seeing here?
Yeah.
And can I ask better questions every time, right? Because I don't always ask the best questions, but can I ask the questions that will help promote growth on my side and so I can go do something about it?
We all got to have these conversations. I'm grateful. I thank you for inviting me to have this one with you.
That was great. I'm so happy you said yes and that you came here. Any parting words as we're wrapping up here? What do you want to leave just like that last punch to be like?
Yeah.
What do you want people to know?
I want to leave what I said earlier. I'm asking you to listen for understanding. And if you can really push back that defense mechanism that makes you want to disagree before you really understand and have heard fully, it will really be helpful to you being able to take in a different perspective and do whatever research you want to do, if that's what comforts you, but also to just consider that there may just be something to what she's saying.
And I will attest, there is a lot to what you're saying, and I hope they listen.
Yeah, thank you.
So Lynn, where can people find you? What's the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, well, LynnMaureenHurdle.com. Lynn with an E on the N, and MaureenHurdle.com is great. I'm on IG, Instagram at Conflict Closer, because that's what I'm known as well for all the work that I'm doing conflict. I'm on LinkedIn, Dr. Lynn Maureen Hurdle on LinkedIn as well. I'm on Facebook, Dr. Lynn Maureen Hurdle. Yeah, you can find me.
For everybody listening, I'll also include all these in the notes. And I want to ask you particularly this last question.
Yeah.
If I'm a white person listening to this right now, and I'm like, this resonates with me, what can I do next? Aside from what you said about listening, like, how can white people take action today?
You can sign up for an interview for our On the Matter of Race program, which is only really for white people who want to learn about racism and take some type of action. And those are 6-month journeys, and they are phenomenal. There are other white people like yourself who are really interested in having the conversations around this and investigating, as you said, Dr. Joe, their own beliefs around this. And so you really should take that next step. We have opened up for new interviews because our next journey begins in January.
Cool. I love that. I've been taking a 6-month journey for like 4 years now. So
it's all different levels. I'm taking the same one over and over.
All different levels. That's right. It's always a new level. I just wanted to say, so if you're a white person listening to this and you want to look in the notes, right, you'll find how to get a hold of Lynn. Her On the Matter of Race journey has been life-changing for me in ways that it's hard to describe. So if you want to take some action, that's a great way to do it. Otherwise, she has a free resource and it's also super amazing. And her summits, like if you can catch one of those, she only invites the best people to come talk at her summits. So it's always worth the time investment to do that. Again, thank you so much for being here, Dr. Lynn. I love you so much.
It's been a great journey and together. So thank you again.
And this has been such a good conversation.
And thank you all for tuning in.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in. And hope you all sign in to listen again to next week's episode. Thanks. Thank you for joining us on Money and Racism. We hope we left you with something to think about. If you like the conversation, make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget, please leave a review. To find out more about the psychology and emotion of money, visit www.josephmburns.com. And if you or someone you know would be a great guest for the podcast, email me at podcast@josephmburns.com. Together, we'll work towards a more equitable and just financial world.